I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Janie Scott grew up on a sprawling estate named Ardrossan on the main line outside of Philadelphia, home to wealthy blue blood families, members of the social register elite. Her grandmother was said to be the inspiration, the model for socialite Tracy Lord, played by Katharine Hepburn in the film The Philadelphia Story. And while there were servants to take care of the 50-room house and horses and a swimming pool and hundreds of acres of woods and farmland, all was not glamorous and fun. Her father, Robert Montgomery Scott, was a prominent figure in the region's civic and cultural life who struggled with alcoholism, self-doubts, and depression. He died in 2005. He gave his daughter access to his journals after his death that revealed family secrets, including extramarital affairs, a suicide, generations of alcoholism, and intimate details about her parents' unhappy marriage. Janie Scott delves into the history of her family in her new book, The Beneficiary, Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Father. She joins us on Radio Times to talk about her family, her childhood, class, and the meaning of inheritance. She was a reporter with the New York Times from 1994 to 2008. In fact, shared a Pulitzer Prize in 2000 with a team of other New York Times reporters. And Janie Scott joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Your book begins with your father's funeral, which was attended by something like 700 people. He was called the Duke of Villanova.
Well, that was a
sort of jokey
term,
right?
That we used in the family. Can't even remember what it dated from, but presumably some moment of slightly amusing grandiosity. We would never have used that term to his face, and we certainly used it affectionately.
With some eye roll, I guess.
A little bit, yes. In fact, one of my siblings thinks that my father may have occasionally used that term as a joke as well.
But why did you start there? And that's how we meet your father.
I began really with the funeral and particularly the reception, because it was really a way of what a good friend of mine calls getting all the balls in the air, introducing the cast of characters, the house, the place, and my father, but also his forebears, who are a key part of the book. So it was really just a way of getting into the story quickly and introducing all these different facets. From that point, which was 2005, I go back 100 years. Yep. And go up, bring it back up to the present in the course of the book.
Well, let's talk about the conversation that you had with your father when he essentially said to you, I'm going to give you my journals when I die. I mean, almost as straightforward as that. What was he telling you?
I have no idea.
Really?
It was completely out of the blue. I believe I was in my 20s, so I assumed he wasn't planning to die in the near future. And he said it almost offhandedly. I want you to have my journals when I die. And I, who had always been both fascinated and baffled by my father, was enormously flattered that he would think about entrusting them to me. And I sort of stuttered, well, why me? And he said, again, kind of offhandedly, you're the writer. Huh? And I was so floored, and I never brought the thing up again. I never dared ask him again about it because I didn't want to seem like I was jumping the gun on his death. And I was afraid that he might decide that he didn't want to give them to me. So, it was mysterious. To answer your question, what was he saying? I figure either he was saying, you're a writer, you might find these useful in some way, or he was saying, you're the only one who'd be interested.
Interesting. Well, you say that you perhaps still suffer from an almost promiscuous inquisitiveness. That certainly described your younger self at the time.
Oh, that continues to be my
to this
disease,
day.
Right? I think it's a journalism problem to some extent, and also a personality problem.
Just being curious and nosy, I guess.
Yes,
is another way of saying
it,
that.
I didn't mean that the term promiscuous had any particular connotation, just a sort of all-purpose curiosity.
Well, he did die in, 2005, and there was a kind of a journey, I guess, to find all these journals. You found them locked in, most of them in a locked trunk, although not a very well-locked trunk. But nonetheless, how did you find them?
Well, When he died, I was working at the Times, and I was not thinking about this project or any project, and so I didn't go looking for them then, and they didn't show up in his possessions when we cleared out his apartment. But when I got interested in doing this book, I thought they might be useful. And I asked around. I asked his girlfriend. She produced a few volumes, but not very much. And I looked everywhere I could think. Couldn't find them. Eventually gave up and was deep into the third chapter writing it when I was in my mother's basement, the house that my father had vacated 20 years earlier, and I stumbled upon a single volume, and it was so extraordinary, beautifully written from his mid-20s, and such an insight into his soul at that moment that I realized I have to search my mother's entire house, because it never occurred to me that he would have left diaries in the house that he had walked out of. So I did, and at the very last place I looked, in a linen closet on the top floor that I was familiar with from childhood, I noticed this wooden chest that I'd never seen kind of shoved back in the corner. And it had a padlock on it, and I thought, that's odd. And I went and took a look at it, and the padlock was set to one digit off the last four digits of my parents' phone number, which was the standard issue combination we always used in the family. So I turned it one digit, pulled it out, opened the thing up, and there was 40 years of diaries in identical black three-ring binders, all organized chronologically as though they were waiting to be discovered.
Both hidden, but also, as you say, waiting to be discovered.
Yeah, I don't even know if they were hidden. They were kind of stored. I just can't imagine how that happened. Did he put them there and figure no one was going to find them? Did he leave them there when he moved out of the apartment? Did he put them there later? Did he want to be understood but not in his lifetime?
Well, that's an interesting question because, I mean, I think in larger and smaller degrees, I think for most of us, our parents are a bit of a mystery. I mean, even though we live with them in such intimate quarters, there are things we do not know about them, and I think probably rightly so to some degree. But were you shocked to read what he had written about, especially about himself in his journals? Or surprised?
It's like something more profound than shock or surprise. I mean, I sensed all along that my father was a complicated person. He was, on the surface, extraordinarily charming, gregarious, accomplished, you know, charming. But there was something else going on that I only kind of intuited as a child, but it interested me. So what I found in the diaries was, I think I describe it in the book, as a person sort of doing exploratory surgery on his soul without the benefit of anesthesia, without the anesthesia of self-pity. They were so frank and so savage in their scrutiny of his own character and behavior. I mean, it was very painful to read and yet remarkable to think of a person going through their life with that kind of awareness of their inner turmoil and yet carrying on in the way that he did as this, you know, wonderful, bon vivant, charming character who people adored in many ways. So it was. I don't even know what the verb is, but yes, yeah. Shocking doesn't quite capture it.
Just and you include sections where he does write about himself, and self-doubt probably doesn't even describe it either. I mean, the kind of even self-flagellation about who he thought he was, his own private self.
Yes, his limitations, his weaknesses, his disappointment with himself. It's pretty devastating.
Yeah. And I should say to our listeners, I interviewed your father years and years ago when he was the president of the Philadelphia Art Museum. So he was a known figure in the Philadelphia region, a very well-known figure, actually, and left his mark on a number of cultural institutions around here.
Absolutely. I'd say a huge figure in Philadelphia and really a very devoted, socially conscious patrician in the old sense of the word who worked very hard for many of the cultural and arts institutions in the city. And I don't think that people probably sensed that he was complicated or more complicated than the exterior would suggest. But I don't think it was possible, especially having watched him close up for a lifetime, to sense precisely the depth of his dissatisfaction.
Yeah, maybe you just answered the question I wanted to ask you, which is where you think this these feelings of inferiority and of self-doubt and of self-criticism, where you think that came from?
Well, not being a psychiatrist, yeah. I'm not in a position to answer that.
I get it.
But I can tell you that I approached this book not to, you know, get inside my father's brain so much. I really was interested when I started out, which was about 7 or 8 years ago, I was interested in writing about the world of Ardrossan and the world that had shaped my father and his mother and us to a certain extent, my siblings and me. I was interested in that, and I was also interested in the puzzle of my father and how a person who led such a seemingly charmed life had spent his last years in what seemed to me to be a sort of protracted act of self-destruction. When he died of cirrhosis in 2005, it sort of crystallized the question, the contrast between these two things. So the book does try to go back and look at the family history, and it does find a history of alcoholism on both sides, a suicide that was buried for decades in his father's family. It was my father's grandfather. He committed suicide in France during World War I, but it was presented by the family, even within the family, as he died nobly, possibly on the battlefield. That turned out not to be quite true. So there was clearly a history of something going on there. My father believed, apparently, that his grandfather had been bipolar, or that was a term he used. Whether it was that notion of a sort of split situation has been around for a long time, if not the term. But whether it would have been at a diagnosable level, had he seen a psychiatrist, I have no idea. But there was a mood issue going on in his grandfather. And my father, in his diaries, clearly reveals, he describes it very, very bluntly, seasonal mood changes, severe mood changes, periods of sort of manic behavior versus depressive behavior. So I don't know what it was, but maybe a combination of personal history, upbringing, culture, and then compounded by alcohol.
And we're almost up in a break here, and it seems like it, showing up in his the self-destructiveness, I guess, showing up in his drinking.
Well, he makes it very clear in the diaries, to my amazement, because he didn't really acknowledge this to us, that he was sort of treating those symptoms with drinking, that was what assuaged them.
Because you could be the sort of life of the party, I guess, or he could be the life of the party, or just sort of dull all those self-doubts.
On the occasions where he attempted not to drink, and there were periods, he said, "I'm just such a bore to myself."
Wow. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Jenny Scott. Excuse me, she's got a new book. It's a memoir. It's called The Beneficiary, subtitled Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Father. Her father, Robert Montgomery Scott, was the president of the Philadelphia Art Museum for a number of years, and as I mentioned, a well-known person in the Philadelphia area, the social and cultural and civic circles. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation after the break. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Again, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with journalist Jenny Scott about her new book. It's a memoir titled The Beneficiary, Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Father. Well, let's talk about Ardrossan, and this is the sprawling estate in Villanova, outside of Philadelphia, along the main line, which is such a character, I have to say, in this story, such a presence in this story. It was built by your...
Great-grandfather.
Your great-grandfather, the Colonel, as he was known. Describe for our listeners Ardrossan.
Well, I spent the first 14 years of my life there, and it was an absolutely idyllic place. Beautiful rolling fields, woods, fantastic stone farmhouses dating from as early as the 18th century. Swimming pools. There was a beautiful pool in the woods that had been built in the 20s. There was a herd of cows, of 300 cows. My father had a pack of beagles in a kennel there. There were horses, tennis courts, and then there was this wonderful array of family members, many of them fascinating in their own different ways. So it was an extraordinary place to grow up.
And you had free range of, what, almost 800 acres, right?
Yeah, 750 to 800. I don't know that anyone's ever got the exact number. But at the
size
time,
of Central Park, I read
yes,
somewhere.
Yes, exactly, on the scale of Central Park. Oh. At the time that I was a child, you could walk basically a mile and a half and cross a single road. So, yes, we could wander all over this place, gave you a lot of independence as a child.
You also describe living in the house, the 50-room house. There were portraits of ancestors, I guess, on the walls. And it's so interesting to think of being a little girl and looking up maybe over the dining room table or something, and there's grandfather staring
well,
down.
Well, actually, we didn't live in the 50-room house.
Okay.
No, when I was a child, my great-grandmother, who was the spouse of the colonel, was living there still. We lived in one of the other houses on the place. No tiny house itself,
no.
But not 50 rooms. But we would go visit all the time. My great-grandmother, who you could pay court in the afternoon and have tea with her. And yes, the walls were covered in portraits, and that was sort of my introduction to the colonel himself, who was dead by the time I came along, and many of that generation. Mm-hmm.
At one point, the colonel, in creating Ardrossan, as you write, ordered a forest.
That's right. And one of the revelations to me, digging into the archives that had accumulated in the house, there was a laundry room full of papers. One of the revelations for me was that this place that had struck me as a child as eternal and changeless and had been there forever and would be there forever was in many ways a creation of the sort of ego and imagination of my great-grandfather, the colonel. He had not only, moved chunks of land and boulders and planted this forest in ostensibly, where the story goes, to block the view of another estate going up a mile away, but he had sort of shaped everything, the landscape, he had drawn up designs of a particular tower he wanted at the stable, a clock tower that he wanted. He had gotten books on servant housing or farmer housing in England and had those copied. So it was fascinating to step back and realize this really was a creation of this one guy's brain.
Should we think Downton Abbey?
Well, it has been said that it's the American counterpart. And
really?
One of my father's cousins said, who was, I was too young to experience these things, but he said that there were these wonderful Sunday night suppers where all the family would get together in the big house. And he said, we weren't missing Downton Abbey. We were Downton Abbey.
Oh, geez. So how did your family make all that money?
Well, that was a whole other question I got to explore because I certainly had no idea.
People didn't talk about money growing up?
Not particularly, no. And I don't think there was any there was no discussion of money particularly, and nor was there any sense that there was we were like rolling in dough or anything like that. It was just this sort of interesting situation. Mm-hmm. So I did do a lot of research to try and understand how Colonel Montgomery came into the money that he had. And it turned out that he had, on the one hand, left school at age 16 and gone straight into the investment banking business, first I think as a kind of clerk at Drexel or somewhere like that, and then went off quickly onto his own firm with some other socially prominent partners. And in the very early years where investment banking was spreading and becoming focused on less on railroads and all sorts of other things, made a whole lot of money very wow. fast. So there was that. And then the ex-husband of a cousin of my father said to me, and there was also the fact that he married, an heir to a banking fortune, and she probably had far more money than he did. So I think it was the combination of those two things.
Did you feel that you were part of this Philadelphia, the sort of blue blood social register elite? Was that something that you thought about as a kid growing up?
No. I mean, yes, the social register was planted next to the phone in the library.
So you didn't call all the right people, right?
But no, I didn't. We left there when I was 14. My family moved to England, and then I went off to college, so I never went back to live there. So I wasn't really thinking before the age of 14 about Philadelphia and blue blood.
Right.
I did know that it was extraordinarily beautiful and that nobody else's grandmother had a herd of 300 cows.
And your grandmother was although she disputes this, was allegedly the model or inspiration, however you want to use the words, for Katharine Hepburn's role in A Philadelphia Story. I mean, that seems to have – that's been all the literature that I got
Absolutely.
About your book. There it is.
Yeah, I'm not even sure how much she disputed it. Occasionally she would say – I don't really think I was that much like her. But yeah, that connection came from my grandfather had wanted to be a playwright, and he'd met Philip Barry, gotten become friendly with Philip Barry at Harvard in a playwriting workshop, and they became very close, and Philip Barry frequently came with his wife to Ardrossan. And when The Philadelphia Story, the play, came out, it was dedicated to my grandparents, and it was if you read the actual script, it's just full of details plucked right out of the life of that household,
wow.
the big house, the 50-room house, and also out of the family. But sometime a little bit later, it just came to be said that my grandmother was the model for Tracy Lord, the inspiration for Tracy Lord, the spoiled mainline heiress. And the fact is, if you look at actually how the play came about and Barry's dealings with Katharine Hepburn, he tailored that character to rescue her from the period as box office poison. And it's probably much more like her, and it serves that purpose than it was ever like my grandmother. But my grandmother did not go out of her way to disabuse reporters of that notion.
And why would she, right?
As my uncle said, she... came to value the importance of being Mrs. Philadelphia's Story.
There's a picture of her standing, a really gorgeous woman, I have to say, with a fancy dog. She has a beautiful dress on and is looking at someone or looking off into the distance, and it's really quite striking.
Yeah, she was a really quite captivating figure. You know, beautiful, charismatic, flirtatious, determined, disciplined, and with an amazing repertoire of racy jokes. It's said that she once bought a horse from a friend for a tin of caviar and a dirty joke every week for a year.
Oh, goodness gracious. So what was your as you read your father's journals, how did he describe his parents?
He didn't describe them very much. Yeah, I really think there's very little that I can recall that was particularly striking. But I can say that my father, in the many interviews he did, often was asked about his parents. And for most of his life, and while they were alive, he spoke about them with the greatest affection. And I think if you'd seen them together, you would have absolutely seen that they both sides adored the other. Toward the end of his life, and after they were dead, my father did, it seems to me, in looking at all the public record, say various things that he hadn't said before, like that it was a very pleasant existence as a child as long as they avoided his mother's temper, which she was known to have quite a temper. And when the light was shining on them, him and his brother, they were certainly there, and other times they made do. So I think my father used to say humorously that he had spoken with an Irish accent until the age of 9 because his parents had very busy lives. They had an apartment in New York, and they had a place further in Chester County, I think, where my grandmother hunted. And so he spent a lot of time with the Irish butler, Irish maid, and Irish cook.
Who essentially what raised him as a little boy or –
I don't know if I could say raised him. I mean, he had all this big family around, too. But I think the sort of daily exposure was sufficient, in his opinion, to give him an Irish accent.
Exactly. You do describe, and I found it so jarring and frankly upsetting. He described the kind of toilet training, to be perfectly honest, the kind of toilet training that he endured. Maybe that was very true of that time and place, but it was so punitive.
Yeah, this is not in his diaries. I don't think this would have gotten into his diaries. He, late-ish in his life, our immediate family and other people executed an intervention, and he went to into alcoholism rehab at McLean Hospital. And while he was there, he was asked to write an autobiography of his drinking, which when we then went to visit him, he was to read to us. And it was in this autobiography, which covered all sorts of things, including the fact that he had begun drinking as a child. He said always in the context of the home, and he remembered at age 11 drinking rum while his grandfather drank brandy and smoked a cigar after lunch. But yes, it's there that he mentions toilet training techniques that he compares to the way one would housebreak a dog.
Yeah.
And yes, if that's correct, and I can't imagine why he'd make it up, that certainly is a technique not in vogue today.
No, not at all. I mean, in certain ways, it may be true for you as well, is the kind of parenting is perhaps the opposite of the helicopter parenting that we hear about today.
Yeah, it's true. I think in that class and in that place, that was not uncommon. My father's cousin, who also grew up on Ardrossan, had many of the same experiences. And we grew up with, I think, a sort of vestigial experience that they had, which was a practice called spending, which is in the evening when your father returns from work, you are brought downstairs to spend a half an hour with your parents. And my father's cousin recalled that and said, yeah, you only had to see your parents a half an hour a day.
Whether you liked it or not.
Yeah.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jani Scott. And she's got a new book. It's a memoir called The Beneficiary, Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Father. And it is about growing up here in the Philadelphia area, on the main line in Philadelphia, and what it was like to live in this very socially and culturally connected family. Here's a comment from James. He says, I'm a dump truck driver, and I deliver stone to the Ardrossan estate all the time. And even now, I'm amazed at how incredible it must have been to have lived there.
That's so true. So true. And it's striking. Even now, as it's being dismantled and developed, it's still extraordinarily beautiful, especially the land. The land is just spectacular. And my grandmother, late in her life, in an oral history interview, when they said, you know, they asked a question that was clearly aimed at getting at some kind of social thing. You know, what is it about the main line that you so love? It's thinking she was going to say, oh, the parties. And
yeah,
she
right.
said, it's the land.
The land, exactly. Now, your dad, it seemed like, spent a lot of time and money trying to restore Ardrossan. I guess after his parents died, a kind of a...
Yeah, and that was part of the puzzle for me. Not only why had his... life ended in what struck me as a self-destructive fashion, but also how he had come to spend a lot of the last 9 years of his life to restoring this house, which he didn't own and had really never lived in until my parents split up after 42 years of marriage. So he moved in there, and it was kind of a wreck at the time because nobody had lived there as a family since my great-grandmother had died in the early 70s, although my cousin was living on the second floor. And he then restored the top floor into a beautiful apartment. And then I think the way people say, you know, it's hard to do one and then not do the next room, he started doing the downstairs, and over a number of years restored it meticulously as though he were doing, you know, period rooms at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, spending a lot of money doing things like getting furniture broken down, re-glued, put back together. I mean, replaced the entire roof of the house for what it cost, he said, for his his grandparents to build the whole place.
Wow. As a kind of homage to his family?
Well, again, that was one of the puzzles that I deal with in the book, because I found it baffling. You know, this is a house that it's not even clear that it has a real use in the 21st century, certainly as domestic, as a domestic phenomenon. So I came to believe that he felt that by restoring the house, it might be preserved, and that might even help preserve some of the land. And he had watched his mother try to hold together the whole place and the family the way her parents had done, and he had that in him, and he obviously loved it. And I also found, which were aspects of his history that I didn't know, that he had been exposed to other big houses earlier on in his life, including on his father's side, an enormous palace in Bar Harbor, Maine, that had to be finally basically torn down because they couldn't sell it after the war. So he had this, in his experience, this reverence for these kind of Gilded Age palaces, and he was going to prevent this one from being destroyed, I think, or do his damnedest.
And how well did he do doing that? Was he able to do that?
Well, the house is still standing.
Well, I was going to say, it's still there. Less land, obviously.
The land is being sold off, and there will remain the house and, I think, 10 or 15 acres. It remains to be seen what happens to it. I think that's a family decision, and I'm not sure what the future is exactly.
So what's it like for you to visit there and to walk the grounds and go in the house? What is it like for you?
Well, I can't go in the house now without thinking of my father, because it became so much his project, his puzzling, admirable puzzling project. My mother still lives on part of what used to be our Drossen, but now belongs to her. And her house is very much the same as it was when I was a child. There's been some development, but it doesn't really intrude upon her view. So while all is changed, nothing is changed.
But does it, when you go there, is it nostalgia? I mean, is it sort of hearkening back to your childhood, or does it feel more distant than that?
I think it feels a bit more distant because I've experienced it at different ages. You know, I was their child there. We went away. We came back. I was a single adult visiting my parents. And then when my children were born, they loved the place. And we spent a lot of time both with my father in the big house and with my mother in her house. So I sort of associate it more with the experience that my children have had. So it's more their loss now than mine.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jani Scott, our guest on Radio Times today. And she's a journalist. In fact, she worked at the New York Times for a number of years, was part of a team of journalists at the Times that received a Pulitzer Prize back in 2000. And her new book is called The Beneficiary, Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Family. You can join us again, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowang, talking with Jani Scott about family, about class, inheritance. And again, she's got a new book called The Beneficiary, Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Father. You write in this book, and I'm quoting you here, that you had, as a younger woman, an aversion to marriage. That was the word that you used. And you went to see a therapist. And you ended up talking about your father. No surprises there, right?
Not the first therapist to bring that up.
No, that often happens. And I know from my own life as well. What do you think that connection, I guess, between your dad and how you felt about marriage?
I don't know if I guess probably what we were talking about was how much was I dependent upon my father's view of what would have been right and who would have been right. And that was not something my father ever would have expressed directly, or he never did to me anyway. He did have opinions about the people that his children brought home and eventually married, but he usually expressed them more indirectly. So I think I, at this point, was out in California. I had a completely different life going, and I was in a very serious relationship. But I think we were probably talking about my unarticulated concern about whether this, that person would meet my father's definition of what was good.
Were you a rebel?
I don't think of myself particularly that way, but my parents, to their credit, and I find this really impressive, never told us, you need to stay here, live on our Drossen the way we did, which was a message that very much came to my father and his generation. My parents' message to us was, figure out what you want to do with your life, what makes you happy and fulfills you, and go do it. So there was never any sense that, you don't go to college more than 200 miles from here, none of that. So I took advantage of that and moved to California.
3,000 miles away. I think it's your brother who says that, that you were your dad's favorite.
Well, yeah.
And I think siblings often feel that way about other siblings, right?
Yeah. My brother, I gave my brother the manuscript when I was about to submit it, and he very sweetly and intelligently said, "Don't you think you should say you were his favorite?" Of course, I didn't want to say that, but I suppose that's probably true.
Because?
I don't know. Probably in many ways I was like him. I don't know. Why are children favored by a parent? Isn't it often because they see themselves in them somehow?
Right.
Or maybe what they...
What they wished to be.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about your father's sort of inner life, about his own struggles with his own self. It's interesting to think about that. I want to have you read a section from the book, and this is part of your father's journal. He's a young man at the time, I guess newly married, and talking about his life.
I am now 26 years old. I live in a beautiful, formal house with grounds which I cannot afford to keep, on a decaying quasi-baronial domain of great beauty in an encroaching suburb. I am a graduate of a law school. I'm paid to practice law by a rather good, stuffy law firm, and I am quite mediocre about it. My life is now what many inner suburbanites strive for endlessly. But I am still a virgin. Is that what I want? My mental virginity is probably greater now than 7 years ago. I'll bet there are plenty of girls who'd like to learn that trick. I am married to a charming wife with whom I have little in common but background. My failure at the tennis court eliminated what she felt to be the sphere in which we would have experiences together, and the result is that we have no common experiences except our background. We live our background. Our houses are two generations of money flowing into more of culture. This is no way to live.
Such a heartbreaking thing to read, and I'm sure for you to read out loud. I mean, to hear and for you to read out loud.
It is remarkable.
Because he's a young man, I mean, with his life in front of him.
I do want to say that you didn't ask me to continue, but he does, in the end of the next paragraph, say, "I'm not looking for another wife, another house, or anything. I need to," he said, "you know, maybe I should retire to the porch until I no longer shrink from contact." But he said, "more likely I should practice each day going forth to live." So he's wrestling with a sense of displacement or something like that. And he is saying, through an act of will, I'm mm-hmm. going to figure this out.
Do you think his journals were his best friend in a way?
I think they were his confidant. I don't know that my father really had a best friend. He had lots and lots and lots of acquaintances, but he confided to a cousin that he felt he had no one he could really talk to about something really grave. I don't know if they were a friend, but I think that's where he expressed the things that other people might have told a friend.
Yeah. A comment from Lou. I was part of the film crew last year at the estate, and Janny was a wonderful host, and the land was spectacular.
Yes, that was, I guess that was for the Criterion Collection edition of the Philadelphia Story.
Oh,
which
really?
They finally got the rights to put out their own version, and they did a little documentary that was wonderful, both about the house and also talking to Philip Barry's granddaughter and people like that.
Oh, that's great. An email from Lynn. I lived less than a quarter of a mile away from our Androsen farm. Each school day we drove by on the bus, I would ponder who lived there, what were their lives like, and just what was up with the stone water tower. Each afternoon I was so tempted to walk up that driveway. The farm and land and the house was of another time.
Yes, absolutely. That's the same feeling I had as a child. This is completely timeless, and it's never going to change.
Yeah.
And now it's going, gone, as my father said, probably 20 years ago, 30 yeah. years ago.
I mean, there was money, but a lot of it was tied up in trusts. And so it's being wealthy, but also not having access to money at the same time, right?
My father's grandparents handled it was they put the property and the houses and lots of things in trust. I think basically, according to my uncle, as a kind of tax avoidance mechanism. And then they locked up these trusts for 100+ years. So unless there's enough income being generated to maintain these buildings, for a long time, the rents on the buildings, which were extraordinarily low, actually did cover a lot of the maintenance, according to my uncle. But I don't think that's the case anymore because it's so hard to keep up these stone houses and, you know, put a roof on.
Your dad, I don't know if he described himself this way, but other people described him as naughty.
Yes, indeed. So they did. They said that they used that in a way that I would say was kind of admiring. But yes, he didn't. I don't think in some ways, particularly in terms of domestic matters and marital fidelity, I don't think he played by the traditional rules. Mm-hmm. So, yes, some people found that charming. And
did you know he was naughty? I mean, as a kid growing up?
Pretty early on, I knew. Well, I viewed my father, I think correctly, as quite charming. And it was clear that people were attracted to him, you know, men and women. And he to them. And he, one of his highest terms of praise was terribly attractive. And I could see that he, too, was terribly attractive. And I could, yes, we sensed subtext in a number of these situations. And over the course of my lifetime, I saw it, you know, much more vividly. But yes, we sort of sensed it as children.
You mentioned the fact that your parents split up after, what, some
42
years. So long time marriage. Were you aware as a kid growing up about some tensions and arguments?
No, of course not.
All hidden.
I think good parents tend to try to keep that out of the sight of their children. Right. So no, I really wasn't, and they didn't. They never fought in front of us or anything like that. I really only saw the extent of the hostilities, whatever you'd call it, in reading my father's diaries. And maybe he exaggerated it, but I was surprised he would say that my mother was in, you know, a blue rage. I mean, I have never in my life seen my mother in a blue rage. So, I was not particularly aware of it.
It's interesting to read about your family and to know more about it, and also to think about today's, you know, very wealthy families where we're reading about them, you know, trying to get their children into these elite colleges and getting in trouble with the law. Is this a book, a cautionary tale, do you think?
I wouldn't say that. For me, this book is a story. I did not set out to, you know, blow the lid off this family or anything like that. I was interested in the story. The deeper I got into it, the more I found myself thinking about the ambiguities of inheritance, not just of money and property, but of values and even genes. And I chose the title, The Beneficiary, because to me it expressed the ambiguity there, that in this charmed world, there are complications that come with the things that are passed down. And I note now that people are making tons and tons of money in ways not all that unlike the way my great-grandfather made his money in finance. And they're doing many of the same things, and the sort of signifiers of success appear to be the same. You know,
big
boats, big houses, lots of land. And land, like in my family, that was put in trust, that was sort of thought about as how do we avoid getting this taxed so we can preserve it. I just wonder how much thought goes into how this plays out over the next 100 years, because surely all over the world, this is happening now again.
It has a kind of Great Gatsby feel to it, to some degree.
Well, thank you, Marty.
I mean, you know what I mean? Sort of living this large and privileged life, but also knowing the sort of the undercurrents as well.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think anyone ever in the family ever thought of it as Gatsby-like. The self-perception is entirely different.
A comment from Hank saying, I used to work for Janny's parents, and I just wanted to say they were great employers, and I'm very grateful to have worked for them.
Hank, that's such a nice thing to say, and they are in the case of my mother and were in the case of my father wonderful people, and I'm not at all surprised to hear that they were great employers.
I do have a couple more questions about your father and his drinking, and I have to say that's really a strong subtext in this story, and even the kind of inheritance of alcoholism within the family. And you mentioned the fact that he went to McLean Hospital in Massachusetts. There really was a kind of a family intervention to try to get him to see that he was in trouble.
Yes, that's exactly what it was. Whether it was well advised, I don't know. We had tried to speak with him about it informally around the kitchen table, and he always got the better of us and denied it was a problem, which is one of the reasons I was so stunned to discover from his diaries that he understood it was a problem long before we did, and you know, as early as his 20s, and had been wrestling with it. But when he spoke to us, it was as though, I've got it under control. So anyway, we finally did do a real intervention with a professional advisor and all, and he later referred to it as a mugging, my father, not the advisor.
Right.
And but he did agree to go into rehab and spend a month there, but of course returned to his life as it was before, to all the same pressures and you know, his work involved an enormous amount of socializing, as many as 100 to 150 events a year, all of which at which alcohol would be served. So the possibilities of my father really living differently in that context, it seems in retrospect kind of crazy. So, he was sober, I now know from the diaries, for about 8 months and then gradually drifted back. But he did really struggle during that period in ways that I don't think any of us were aware of.
You do describe a bicycle trip where, I mean, he could drink a lot or even be out on a vacation or even a hiking trip and bicycle 100 miles the next day. I mean, talk about the sort of duality there, right?
Yeah, he was physically phenomenally strong. That was in his late 50s and 60s. We did a series of, he was a very serious bicyclist, eventually long-distance touring bike trips through different parts of the world. And my brother and I went with him one time to New Zealand. And on about the third night, my father had been drinking heavily every single night after an exhausting day of riding. And he was by far the oldest person on the trip, and he would always ride at the front. He prided himself on, as he said, showing the younger people that a fat old guy could do it just as well. And to our chagrin, a complete stranger in our group came up to us and said, "Why haven't you tried to help him?"
Wow.
So that was sobering.
Sobering. I mean, help him in that seeing...
Get him help.
Right.
Yeah.
Seeing, I guess, what happened at night.
Right. They would see. And as you say, you know, we would ride 100 miles on some days. And then, the following day, doing that after, you know, waking up with a terrible hangover. I mean, really, he was killing himself.
Yeah. What do you think your dad would have thought of this book?
I don't know.
Of course.
I think there's no question in my mind that he would have been proud of me for pulling it off. Whether he would buy my interpretation of his life as told through his diaries, I don't know. Someone asked me that question in an event at a book launch last night in New York, and I gave that answer, and my brother, who was there, emailed me today and said, "Well, you were right not to say it, but of course he would have loved the book. I have no doubt."
Because it's about him, right?
I don't know. I didn't get a chance to ask him why. It was a text.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Jenny Scott, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's been a great pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And again, the book is called The Beneficiary, Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Father. I should add that she will be speaking Monday night at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And Jenny Scott spent a number of years from 1994 to 2008 at the New York Times. In fact, shared a Pulitzer Prize back in 2000 with a team of other New York Times reporters, and also wrote a book called A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.